tuned to firstamendmentradio.com to find out first, and on satellite at Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70. Are you? That is the question and the name of the program. To learn what the question means and what the answers are, tune in every Sunday afternoon and Rice McLeod will give you the answers. Who are you? Check the schedule pages at firstamendmentradio.com for broadcast times. We'll see you then. Years ahead of the dominant media, find out first on firstamendmentradio.com, on satellite, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
Welcome to another edition of American Exposé. Darren Weeks here with you on June 6th, 2005, as the summer rolls along, or quickly approaches anyway. Glad that you're spending a little time with us here tonight, as we have some good information to share with you. At the outset of the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you about a bill that's pending in Congress right now that we all need to be aware of. These little critters continue to push their agenda forward. Of Homeland Security and everyone spying on everyone else, and this bill is along those lines. H.R. 1528, website called drugpolicy.org, writes, they say, "We're in the fight of our lives in Washington, D.C. High-ranking members of Congress want to take the war on drugs to a whole new level. They want to increase penalties for every drug offense. They want a mandatory two-year term for anyone... A mandatory two-year prison term for anyone who knows someone is selling marijuana on a college campus and fails to report it to police within 24 hours. They want a mandatory five-year prison term for someone at a party who passes a marijuana joint to someone who has been enrolled in drug treatment at some point in their life. They want to expand the federal three strikes and you're out law to include new offenses, including mandating life imprisonment. With no possibility of parole for anyone convicted a third time under the RAVE Act." They say these and other horrible provisions are inside Congressman Sessenbrenner's H.R. 1528, entitled Defending America's Most Vulnerable, Safe Access to Drug Treatment and Child Protection Act of 2005. You helped us derail this bill last year, they say, and now it's back. It's no longer, it's longer, by the way, and more draconian. This person writing this says, I'm not going to lie. We're up against the most powerful forces in the federal government. We hope you will continue to stand with us in this massive showdown. Some of you have already taken action in key congressional districts, and it's had an impact. Once on the fast track, the bill has stalled in committee. Drug war extremists are regrouping, however, and it's only a matter of time before they strike back. We need to keep the heat on members of Congress to kill this bill. In short, we're up against a Goliath, but we have tens of thousands of Davids like you on our side. Now, I want to go through a little more of this real quickly because we have some other things planned for tonight. They say, in a separate piece, they say, I want to thank over 4,400 people who have sent emails to their representatives opposing Congressman Sussenbrenner's draconian mandatory minimum sentencing bill. This bill is now garnering national attention. They say it would have serious consequences for our democracy. And ladies and gentlemen, that's a part of the lie. That's a part of the inside the dialectic thinking. We don't have a democracy. We have a representative republic here in America. And there's a big difference if you're a new listener. They say this bill would require you to spy on all your neighbors, including going undercover and wearing a wire if needed. Refusing to become a spy for the government would be punishable by a mandatory prison sentence of at least 2 years. They say, we need your help to fight this bill, including your ideas. We alerted you last week to the bill entitled Defending America's Most Vulnerable, Safe Access to Drug Treatment and Child Protection Act of 2005. And the bill number, again, ladies and gentlemen, is H.R. 1528. It's H.R. 1528. Thousands of you faxed Congress in opposition to the bill, and we've already raised $2,000 online to fight it. I say we've already told you about many of the terrible provisions in the legislation, but we're especially concerned about a section of the bill that turns every American into an agent of the state. Here's how it works. If you witness certain drug offenses taking place or learn that they took place, you would have to report the offense to law enforcement within 24 hours and provide full assistance in the investigation, apprehension, and prosecution of the people involved. Failure to do so, failure to report your neighbors, your brothers, your sisters, your relatives, failure to rat on people would be punishable by a mandatory 2-year prison sentence. Here are some examples of offenses you would have to report to the police within 24 hours. You see someone you know pass a joint to a 20-year-old college student. Your cousin mentions that he bought ecstasy for some of his college friends. You find out that your brother, who has kids, recently bought a small amount of marijuana to share with his wife. Your substance-abusing daughter recently begged her boyfriend to find her some drugs, even though they're both in drug treatment. In each of these cases, you face jail time if you don't call the police within 24 hours. It doesn't matter if the offender is your friend or relative. It also doesn't matter if you need 48 hours to think about it. You have to report the person to the government within 24 hours or go to jail. That's, of course, assuming that they find out about it. You also have to assist the government in every way, including wearing a wire if needed. Refusing to cooperate would cost you at least 2 years in prison, possibly up to 10. In addition to turning your family members against other family members, the legislation could also put many Americans into dangerous situations by forcing them to go undercover to gain evidence against strangers. This is what we're up against in Congress, and they say, as I told you last week, it's not going to be easy. Ladies and gentlemen, like everything else, this could be stopped at a state level. We need to call our state legislators and alert them that this thing is going on at a federal level and urge them to take action against this. But if you'd like to call Congress, the number to call Congress, and again, the bill number, let's see, let me find it again here. Well, here, I'll tell you what, I got the reference right here. As a matter of fact, this was, it's H.R. 1528, H.R. 1528, and as I see before me from Thomas, the Library of Congress website. It was last referred to the Subcommittee on Health for a period to be subsequently determined by the chairman, they say. That was on April 22nd. So nothing's been done with it for a while, but this thing needs to die. And so while you should call your federal legislator, also call your state legislator as well. Again, the bill number is H.R. 1528, H.R. 1528, and it's a hideous, hideous bill. And I'll put this information up on the website, AmericanExpose.com, American spelled with a K, not a C, after the broadcast tonight. Other things going on real quickly. Ladies and gentlemen, by the way, tonight we're going to be sharing a recording. And we're not going to get the entire recording in because it's longer than the broadcast is. And so we'll probably continue it on Friday. But this is a recording that we're going to have tonight about September 11th that was actually aired on C-SPAN. It's amazing. This is information that was sent to me from Jackie Petru, my colleague in this movement and dear friend, Jackie Petru. But before I get to that, I want to cover one more thing. The Central American Free Trade Agreement is also, while you're on the phone with your congressman to talk about H.R., what was it, 1528? Yeah, H.R. 1528. Also talk to him about the Central American Free Trade Agreement, because apparently my sources are telling me here that it's scheduled for a vote on the 14th of this month. They're trying to get this thing through, and we see how wonderful that NAFTA has turned out to be for this country. What a wonderful thing NAFTA has been, as we've watched all of our jobs disappear south of the border. Well, now we're going to have the Central American Free Trade Agreement. So we're going to have migration from Central America. We're going to have job exodus to Central America. It's just a nasty, nasty, nasty situation, and folks, we have to counter it. We have to do what we can to preserve what's left of this country, because if America dies, this is the last best hope for the world. This country is the last bastion of freedom, and we've never really known truly liberty in our whole life. But it's necessary to do what we can. We have a God-given responsibility. To whom much has been given, much is required, ladies and gentlemen. And liberty requires eternal vigilance. But John Hamill's organization, John Hamill's, I believe it's John Hamill himself, writes, to defend against Codex harmonization, I am flying to Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, June 7th, in an effort to kill CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which is expected to have a markup vote in the Senate on June 14th, and still need emergency donations for this urgent lobbying trip. They say see the PayPal button at www.iahf.com or please send a donation to IAHF 556 Boundary Bay Road. That's B-O-U-N-D-A-R-Y Bay, B-A-Y, Road, Point Roberts, Washington, 98281. They say what you can do and why your help is urgently needed. They say it's urgent to attack this week. Two important legislative actions must be taken into consideration this week to defend your access to dietary supplements. Number one, HJ, that's House Joint Resolution 27, which gets us out of the WTO, will go to the House floor on Tuesday, June 6th. Well, I guess that was today. Congressman Ron Paul urges vitamin consumers to support this bill. So that's House Joint Resolution 27. And so you can support that, too, as well. So a lot of... I'm not going to share this entire thing. I guess I'll post this on the website as well for your perusal. You want solutions out there, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we explore here. We explore solutions, and there's certainly no shortage of directions that you can take in trying to preserve the liberty that we have. So without further delay, and by the way, while we're talking about support, support First Amendment Radio as well. The website for First Amendment Radio is www.firstamendmentradio.com. You can go there and make a donation, or the mailing address is there if you don't want to make a donation online. And it's very important that you do so, because we're not going to be here to be able to share this information with you if the network isn't supported. We have to have a sustainable network. Continuing on here, we have this information. Now, again, this is a recording that was given. The organization that sponsored this is called the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth. Now, I don't know who this organization is. I can't endorse them because I know nothing about them. However, they sponsored this event, which was broadcast on C-SPAN, and it's just unbelievable the information that was shared on that broadcast. And from what Jackie tells me, this broadcast, she had seen it more than once. So apparently this thing was repeatedly broadcast on C-SPAN, and I don't know the date. I just know that it was fairly recent, and it has a lot of good information. So she sent me the link, and with much manipulation, I was able to get the original MP3 file. And so we're going to share that information with you tonight and try to get through it, as much of it as possible. A lot of this information that this guy explores, and his name is David Griffin, a lot of the information he explores is information that we've talked about in the past, including the what I think is one of the most damning pieces of evidence about September 11th, the Project for a New American Century report called Rebuilding America's Defenses, because they map out the whole war on terror ahead of time, and certainly the PNAC report was published a full year before September 11th was executed, and they say in the report that they need another Pearl Harbor, because otherwise the agenda for the PNAC report, the stuff that they hope to get accomplished, would take a number of years to be able to implement unless they had a new Pearl Harbor. So very damning evidence. And so without further delay, I want to get into this, because if I rattle on for the next 15 minutes, we'll be halfway through the broadcast. This is, let me give you a little background. You'll hear an introduction by an unnamed guy, and then he'll introduce the main speaker, which is David Griffin. Again, this is a speech that was given, broadcast on national television, in the mainstream media, on C-SPAN, about September 11th, and the evidence against it.
Over to David Griffin. Let me say a few words about the main sponsor of tonight's talk, Mujkinet, the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth. That's on the web at mujka.com. That's M-U-J-C-A. I know it's ugly. I apologize and take full responsibility, but it's M-U-J-C-A, Mujka. I don't know what language that sounds like it comes from, but I don't know if I want to learn it. In any case, the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth wants Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and everybody else who wants the monotheists to stop killing each other, to sit down together and look at the facts of 9/11. Whoever was responsible for that crime, it is clear they intended to sow seeds of hatred and violence between the Abrahamic faith traditions. We aim to put an end to that hatred and violence. It is my pleasure here tonight to welcome a man whose work on process theology, interfaith dialogue, and especially 9/11 truth represents a truly historic contribution to this cause. Ladies and gentlemen, David Ray Griffin.
First time to University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've always heard this is an extraordinary place, but now I see it's like that town in a neighboring state here where everybody is good-looking and far above average. The title of my talk tonight is 9/11 and the American Empire. How should religious people respond? I will begin by unpacking those three terms, 9/11, American Empire, and religious people, starting with the third. Although I am a Christian theologian, I am in this talk addressing religious people in general. I am doing so because I believe that religious people should respond to 9/11 and the American Empire in a particular way because of the moral principles of their religious tradition that are common to all the historic religious traditions. I have in mind principles such as, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's oil. Thou shalt not murder thy neighbors in order to steal their oil. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbors, accusing them of illicitly harboring weapons of mass destruction in order to justify killing them to steal their oil. This language is, of course, language that we associate with the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But the same basic ideas can be found in other religious traditions. I turn now to the term American Empire, which has been a highly contentious term. In his 2002 book, American Empire, Andrew Bacevich points out that it was long a cherished American tradition that the United States is not and cannot be an empire. The words American Empire, he adds, were fighting words, so that uttering them was almost a sure sign that one was a left-wing critic of American foreign policy. But as Bacevich also points out, this has all recently changed, so that now even right-wing commentators freely acknowledge the existence of the American Empire. As columnist Charles Krauthammer said in 2002, people are coming out of the closet on the word empire. This new frankness often includes an element of pride, as exemplified by Krauthammer's statement that America is no mere international citizen, but the dominant power in the world, more dominant than any since Rome. Given this consensus about the reality of the American Empire, the only remaining matter of debate concerns its nature. The new frankness about the American Empire by conservatives is generally accompanied by portrayals of it as benign. Robert Kagan has written of the benevolent empire. Dinesh D'Souza, after writing in 2002 that America has become an empire, added that happily, it is the most magnanimous imperial power ever. Krauthammer says, the fact that America's claim to being a benign power is not mere self-congratulation is shown by its track record. Commentators from the left, however, have a radically different view. A recent book by Noam Chomsky is subtitled America's Quest for Global Dominance. Richard Falk has written of the Bush administration's Global Domination Project, which poses the threat, he says, of global fascism. Chalmers Johnson was once a conservative who believed that American foreign policy aimed at promoting freedom and democracy. But he now describes the United States as a military juggernaut intent on world domination. Andrew Bacevich is another conservative who has recently changed his mind. Unlike Johnson, he has not come to identify with the left, but he has come to agree with its assessment of the American Empire. He now ridicules the claim that the promotion of peace, democracy, and human rights, and the punishment of evildoers, not the pursuit of self-interest, has defined the essence of American diplomacy. pointing out that the aim of the U.S. military has been to achieve something approaching omnipotence, Pavlovich mocks the idea that such power in America's hands is by definition benign. If the American empire is interpreted in different ways, the same is true all the more so for the term 9/11. For those Americans who accept the official interpretation, 9/11 was a surprise attack on the U.S. government and its people by Islamic terrorists. For some Americans, 9/11 has a more complex meaning. This second group, while accepting the official interpretation of the attacks, thinks of 9/11 primarily as an event that was used opportunistically by the Bush administration to extend the American empire. This interpretation is effectively presented by writers such as Noam Chomsky, Rahul Mahajan, and Chalmers Johnson. For a third group of Americans, the name 9/11 connotes an event with a more sinister dimension. These citizens believe that the Bush administration knew the attacks were coming and intentionally let them happen. Although no national poll has been taken to ascertain how many Americans in general hold this view, a Zogby poll in New York surprisingly indicated that almost half of the residents of New York City held that view. According to a fourth view of 9/11, the attacks were not merely foreknown by the Bush administration, they were orchestrated by it. Although thus far no poll has tried to find out how many Americans hold this view, polls in Canada and Germany taken some time back indicated that this view was already held by 15 to 20% of their people. Religious people who take the moral principles of their religious tradition seriously will probably have very different attitudes about the American empire, depending on which of these four views they hold. If they accept the official view, according to which America was the innocent victim of evil terrorists, then it is easy for them to think of America's so-called war on terror as a just war. This is a position taken by Jean Bethke Elstein, a professor of ethics at the University of Chicago's Divinity School, in a book called Just War Against Terror. From this perspective, the war on terror has nothing to do with imperial design. It is simply a war to save the world from evil terrorists. Second interpretation of 9/11, according to which the Bush administration cynically exploited the 9/11 attacks to further its imperial plans, has quite different implications. Although it thinks of the attacks as surprise attacks, planned entirely by external enemies of America, it regards these attacks as blowback for injustices perpetrated by U.S. imperialism. The second view typically regards the American response to the attacks of 9/11 as far worse than the attacks themselves. They've already led to hundreds of thousands of deaths. This interpretation of 9/11 would lead people who take their religion's moral principles seriously to support a movement to change U.S. foreign policy. An even stronger reaction would be evoked by the third interpretation, for it entails that the Bush administration allowed thousands of its own citizens to be killed on 9/11, deliberately and cold-bloodedly, for the sake of advancing its imperial interests, and then used this event as an excuse to kill hundreds of thousands of people in other lands, while hypocritically portraying itself as promoting a culture of life. Of course, those who accept the previous interpretation know that hypocrisy with regard to the sanctity of life has long been a feature of official U.S. rhetoric. And yet most Americans, if they learned that their government had deliberately let their own citizens be killed, would surely consider this betrayal qualitatively different. For this would be treason, a betrayal of the oath taken by American political leaders to protect their own citizens. If this third view implies that the Bush administration is guilty of a heinous and even treasonous crime, this is all the more the case with the fourth view.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
In this day of economic uncertainty and soaring unemployment, safe investments are often hard to find. But investing in the precious metals is the safest investment of all, because gold and silver is real money. Government-printed currency is not. Call Melody Cederstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company at 1-800-375-4188. Melody has been helping people secure their financial future for over 10 years. While others in the business claim honesty, Melody will deliver. Give her a call, 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
Be sure to listen to The Church at Kaweah every Saturday and Sunday at 7 a.m. and 11 p.m. Pacific Time. The Church at Kaweah is a Lordship Church under the sole authority of Jesus Christ. You may contact The Church at Kaweah by calling 559-561-4860. That's 559-561-4860. And let them know how much you're being blessed. Thank you.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at FirstAmendmentRadio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25, or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. You may also adopt an hour of your favorite program. Please don't forget that most of the programs on FirstAmendmentRadio.com are listener-supported. Don't do Internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to American Exposé. Before the break, we were sharing a recording by David Griffin about September 11th. I want to get back into this as soon as possible because the hour is quickly racing by. He was talking a little bit about American imperialism, and now he's going to turn a corner and talk about the specific evidence for the school of thought that September 11th was not only they not only knew about it in advance, but actually planned it. Once again, David Griffin.
And yet most Americans, if they learned that their government had deliberately let their own citizens be killed, would surely consider this betrayal qualitatively different. For this would be treason, a betrayal of the oath taken by American political leaders to protect their own citizens. If this third view implies that the Bush administration is guilty of a heinous and even treasonous crime, this is all the more the case with the fourth view. For many Americans, the idea that we are living in a country whose own leaders planned and carried out the attacks of 9/11 is simply too horrible to entertain. Unfortunately, however, there is considerable evidence for this view. And if we find this evidence convincing, The implications for resistance to the U.S. empire building project are radical. As Basevich has emphasized, the only remaining debate about the American empire is whether it is benign. The interpretation of 9/11 is relevant to this debate because it would be very difficult to accept either the third or the fourth interpretation and still consider American imperialism benign. So I now turn to some of the evidence that supports these views. I will look first at evidence that supports at least the third view, according to which U.S. officials had foreknowledge of the attacks. A central aspect of the official story about 9/11 is that the attacks were planned entirely by Al-Qaeda, with no one else knowing the plans. A year after the attacks, FBI Director Robert Mueller said, "To this day, we have found no one in the United States except the actual hijackers who knew of the plot." Since that time, federal officials have had to admit that they had received far more warnings prior to 9/11 than they had previously acknowledged. But these admissions, while raising the question of why further safety measures were not in place, do not necessarily show that the federal officials had specific foreknowledge of the attacks. One could still, as the 9/11 Commission did, accept the conclusion published at the end of the 2002 Congressional Joint Inquiries Report, which said that none of the intelligence gathered by the U.S. intelligence community identified the time, place, and specific nature of the attacks that were planned for September 11, 2001. Unfortunately for the official account, however, there are reports indicating that federal officials did have that very specific kind of information. I will give two examples. The first example involves Attorney David Shippers, who had been the chief prosecutor for the impeachment of President Clinton. 2 days after 9/11, Shippers declared that he had received warnings from FBI agents about the attacks 6 weeks earlier, warnings that included both the dates and the targets. These agents had come to him, Shippers said, because FBI headquarters had blocked their investigations and had threatened them with prosecution if they went public with their information. So they asked Shippers to use his influence to get the government to take action to prevent the attacks. And Shippers surely, as the prosecutor of Clinton, should have had influence in Republican circles. And yet he reports that he tried to contact Attorney General Ashcroft, and Ashcroft repeatedly refused to return his calls. Shippers' allegations about the FBI agents were then corroborated in a story by William Norman Grigg called "Did We Know What Was Coming?", which was published in The New American, a conservative magazine. According to Grigg, the three FBI agents he interviewed told him that the information provided to Shippers was widely known within the FBI before September 11th. If Shippers, Grigg, and these agents are telling the truth, it would seem that when FBI Director Mueller claimed that the FBI had found no one in this country with advanced knowledge of the plot, he was not telling the truth. The government also would have had foreknowledge of the attacks because of an extraordinarily high volume of put options purchased in the 3 days before 9/11. To buy put options for a particular company is to bet that its stock price is going to go down. These purchases were for two and only two airlines, American and United, the two airlines whose planes were used in the attacks, and also for Morgan Stanley Dean Witter, which occupied 22 stories of the World Trade Center. The price of these shares did, of course, plummet after 9/11. As the San Francisco Chronicle said, these unusual purchases, which resulted in profits of at least tens of millions of dollars, raised suspicions that the investors had advanced knowledge of the strikes. For our purposes, the most important implication of this story follows from the fact that U.S. intelligence agencies monitor the market, looking for signs of imminent untoward events. These extraordinary purchases, therefore, would have suggested to intelligence agencies that in the next few days, United and American airliners were going to be used in attacks on the World Trade Center. That is fairly specific knowledge. These two examples then imply the falsity of the joint inquiry statement that none of the intelligence gathered by the U.S. intelligence community identified the time, place, and specific nature of the attacks. Indeed, one of the FBI agents interviewed by William Grigg said, "Obviously, people had to know. It's terrible to think this, but this must have been allowed to happen as part of some other agenda." He was right. This would be terrible. There is considerable evidence, however, that the full truth is even more terrible. That the reason some officials had foreknowledge of the attacks is because they had planned them. The evidence for this fourth view consists of features of the attacks in conjunction with behavior of U.S. officials that cannot be explained on the assumption that the attacks were planned and executed entirely by foreign agents. I will give four examples. One feature of the attacks that suggests complicity by U.S. officials is the twofold fact that the U.S. military failed to stop the attacks on 9/11, and that then, since then, they have given us three different stories as to why they failed. These changing stories suggest that the military has been trying to cover up the fact that a stand-down order was given on 9/11, canceling the military's own standard operating procedures for dealing with hijacked airplanes. It is certainly clear that some agency, either the military or the FAA, failed to follow standard procedures on 9/11. When these procedures are followed, the FAA, as soon as it sees signs that a plane may have been hijacked, calls military officials, who then call the nearest Air Force base with fighters on alert, telling it to send up a couple of fighters to intercept the plane. Such interceptions usually occur within 10 to 20 minutes after the first sign of trouble. This is a routine procedure happening about 100 times a year. If you've read the story in Popular Mechanics, you know, one of their big lies is, "Oh, gee, there's only been one such interception in the last several years." No, it's a routine procedure about 100 times a year. On 9/11, however, it did not happen. Why not? The military's first story was that no planes were sent up until after the Pentagon was hit. The military leaders were admitting, therefore, that they had left their fighters on the ground for almost 90 minutes after the FAA had first noticed signs of a possible hijacking. This first story suggested to many people that a stand-down order must have been given. By the end of the week, the military had put out a second story, saying that it had sent up fighters, but that that because the FAA had been very late in notifying it about the hijackings, the fighters arrived too late in each case. One problem with this story is if the FAA personnel had responded so slowly, heads should have rolled, but none did. An even more serious problem is that even assuming the truth of the late notification times, the military fighters still had time to intercept the hijacked airliners before they were to hit their targets. The second story implied, therefore, that standard procedures had been violated by the military as well as by the FAA. To try to defend the military against this accusation, the 9/11 Commission report gave us a third story, according to which the FAA, after giving the military insufficient warning about the first hijacked airline, gave it absolutely no warning about the other three until after they had crashed. But as I have pointed out in my second book on 9/11, the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, this account is wholly implausible. Besides portraying the
cut off. I don't know if we're on the air right now. I assume that we are, but I just want to let you know the reason that we've had dead air is because we were cut off. We're going to continue now. What you're listening to, in case you just tuned in, is a presentation by David Griffin, and this is a function that was put on by the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth, and their website is MUJCA.com. That's MUJCA.com. And we'll post a link to this on AmericanExpose.com. I don't know if this group is trustworthy, but they're certainly helping to get the truth out about 9/11, and that's what we need. So without further delay, let's continue on with David Griffin as he continues his information.
...is whether the Pentagon was hit by American Airlines Flight 77, as the official account says, or by military aircraft. Either story, however, implies that the attack was, at least partly, an inside job. If we assume that the Pentagon was struck by Flight 77, we must ask, how could this have occurred? The Pentagon is surely the best defended structure on the face of the planet, for three reasons. First, it is only a few miles from Andrews Air Force Base, which has at least three squadrons of fighter jets on alert at all times to protect the nation's capital. Of course, part of the official story is that Andrews was not keeping any fighters on alert. But as I think I showed convincingly in my book, this story is completely implausible. The second reason the Pentagon is so well defended is that the U.S. military has the best radar systems in the world. One of its systems, it has bragged, does not miss anything occurring in North American airspace. This system is also said to be capable of monitoring a great number of airborne attack objects simultaneously, such as would be necessary in the case of a massive missile attack. Given that capability, the official story, according according to which Flight 77 flew toward the Pentagon undetected for 40 minutes is absurd. Any unauthorized airplane coming towards the Pentagon would have been detected and intercepted long before it got close. Third, the Pentagon is ringed by anti-missile batteries, which are programmed to destroy any aircraft entering the Pentagon's airspace, except for any aircraft with a U.S. military transponder that would radiate a friendly signal. If, by some fluke, Flight 77 had entered the Pentagon's airspace, it could have escaped being shot down only if officials in the Pentagon had deactivated the anti-aircraft system. So even if we accept the official story, according to which the Pentagon was hit by Flight 77 under the control of Al-Qaeda hijackers, we must conclude that the attack succeeded only because the Pentagon wanted it to succeed. But there are many reasons to reject the official story. First, the alleged pilot, Hani Hanjour, was widely known as a terrible pilot who could not possibly have flown the trajectory of the aircraft that hit the Pentagon. Second, this aircraft hit the Pentagon's west wing, which would have been the least likely spot for terrorists with any intelligence whatsoever, and these guys were supposed to be so bright, they out-tricked our whole Air Force defense system. They would not have chosen the west wing. Why? Well, in the first place, as already indicated, to hit the west wing, the aircraft had to execute a very complex maneuver, which even some experienced pilots would probably have trouble doing with that size of an airliner. Second, the west wing was being renovated. So instead of having thousands of people in it who would have been killed, it only had a few hundred. And most of them were not military people, they were civilians working on the renovation. Thirdly, you would think the terrorists, if they hate America and they wanted to strike at the Pentagon, the symbol of American military strike, they would have wanted to kill as many of the top brass and Donald Rumsfeld himself. They're over in the East Wing, as far as you could be away from the West Wing. Finally, the West Wing had been, the renovation involved a great reinforcement. So the damage was much less to the West Wing than it would have been any other part of the building. Another problem with the official story is that the initial damage to the West Wing's facade was far too minimal to have been caused by the impact of a Boeing 757. Fourth, photographs and eyewitnesses in the immediate aftermath failed to provide unambiguous evidence of the remains of a Boeing 757. Fifth, there are videos that would show whether the aircraft that struck the Pentagon was, in fact, a Boeing 757. But the FBI confiscated these videos within minutes after the attacks, and now the authorities have refused to release them. Sixth, the fact that the aircraft was not shot down by the Pentagon's anti-aircraft defense system suggests that it belonged to the U.S. military. So, whether or not the Pentagon was hit by Flight 77, the evidence suggests it must have been an inside job. We can conclude the same thing about the attacks on the World Trade Center. Why? Because the collapses of the Twin Towers and Building Number 7 had to have been examples of controlled demolition, brought about by thousands of explosives placed throughout each of the buildings. No foreign terrorists could have obtained the kind of access to the buildings this would have required. One reason for concluding that the three buildings were brought down by explosives is the very fact that they did collapse. High-rise steel-frame buildings have never, before or after 9/11, been caused to collapse by fire. Even when, as in the Philadelphia fire of 1999 and the Madrid fire of February of this year, the fires were much larger, much hotter, and much longer lasting than any of the fires in the World Trade Center. The second reason is the specific nature of the collapses, each feature of which points to explosives. For example, the buildings collapsed straight down and at virtually free fall speed, as in controlled demolitions. And then the rubble smoldered for months afterwards. With regard to the Twin Towers in particular, many people in the building said that they saw, they felt, or heard explosions. Virtually all the concrete of these enormous structures was pulverized into very fine dust. Try this. Get a piece of concrete and drop it a little over 1,000 feet and see if it pulverizes into very fine dust. It won't happen. Much of this dust, along with steel and aluminum, was blown out horizontally from the buildings several hundred feet. Most of the steel beams and columns came down in sections about 30 feet long, conveniently ready to be loaded onto trucks. And pools of molten steel were found beneath the rubble. These and even more effects point to the existence of very powerful, precisely placed explosives. A third thing supporting the theory of controlled demolitions is evidence of a deliberate cover-up. If the building's steel columns and beams had indeed been broken by explosives, an examination of the steel would have revealed this fact. However, although it is normally a federal offense to remove anything from a crime scene, the steel was quickly loaded onto trucks and put on ships headed for Asia to be melted down. I will mention one more example of the cover-up. Insofar as there is an official story as to why the towers collapsed, it is the pancake theory, according to which the floors above the destruction caused by the airplanes collapsed on the floor below, and then those floors collapsed on the floor below that, and then it pancaked all the way down. Now, even if this theory were remotely plausible, can you imagine it pancaking at freefall speed? The other problem is, what happened to the 47 massive steel columns that constituted the core of each of these twin towers?
Ladies and gentlemen, we're out of time. We have to conclude the broadcast. What you've been listening to is Dave Griffin at a function that was sponsored by the organization is the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth. And their website is mujca.com, and that's mujca.com, and we'll post the link on American.